We think this is going to last a while, so we're taking it as a marathon, not a sprint.
The state opens a swine flu response center. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 28th of April. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, environmental groups say today's change to the Endangered Species Act is not enough.
In the end, if you don't deal with global warming, there is no way you're going to save the polar bear from extinction.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP. Giving back to the community is a priority because so many at BP call Alaska home.
The State Health Department set up an emergency operations center today to respond to the threat of the swine flu outbreak. There are no confirmed cases yet in Alaska, but 64 people have fallen ill in the United States. The new emergency center is in a room at the Public Health Lab in Anchorage. Long tables hold rows of computers and phones where state workers gather new information on the disease and answer questions from various agencies and healthcare providers. Jim Mackin is directing the operation. He says the state is hoping for the best while preparing for the worst.
We're very concerned, as everybody should be. Not alarmed, not scared. Be prepared, not scared. We've been saying that for years for pandemic influenza. But we're expecting this to last some time. It's likely that it will. It's shown no signs of slowing down. In fact, it continues to spread. We're feeling very blessed, knock on wood, that in the United States anyway, all of the cases so far, except for one hospitalization, have been very mild.
Mackin says one of the biggest concerns he's hearing from healthcare providers in the state is how they can identify swine flu. He says doctors can call the state epidemiology hotline for a consultation on any suspected cases. Providers are also wondering how to get the antiviral medication that has been effective in treating the illness. Right now, the state has about 100,000 courses of treatment. Mackin says it's mostly in the state's hubs, but officials are ready to get it to other communities quickly if necessary.
If we're keeping all of the drug here in Anchorage and somebody's sick in Igigik, it may not always be easy to get it from Anchorage to Igigik. So try to stay ahead of the problem by staying one step ahead of the disease, if you will. If it's in the lower 48, it's not here yet, we want it in our hubs. Once it's in Alaska and we know it's here, get it out into the villages before it shows up out there. That way, you've got the best chance of getting it to the individual prior to symptoms taking over and the individual becoming very ill.
Mackin says the state has done a lot of work over the past few years preparing for this type of outbreak. Health officials say it is only a matter of time until the flu gets here, given the frequency of travel to and from Mexico and infected areas in the lower 48. In Anchorage, the recently opened Mexican consulate is fielding calls from concerned Mexicans in Alaska. Consul Jose Luis Cuevas says the consulate is in close contact with Mexican federal officials.
We are in constant touch 24 hours a day.
The possibility is strong that swine flu will show up in Alaska because Mexico is such a popular vacation destination with Alaskans, and many Mexicans who live in Alaska travel home from time to time. Cuevas says the embassy is getting calls from some in the Mexican community in Anchorage who are concerned about relatives in Mexico and others about what to do if the flu strikes.
And we've been getting constant telephone calls advising people, you know, regardless of their immigration status, if they don't feel right and if they feel that maybe coming down with this particular influenza stream, then they should contact their doctor immediately.
He says the immigration status of an individual is not a barrier to treatment in case of illness.
In the event that you do have a health problem, there's no problem if you go to a hospital. It's better to have that taken care of sooner than later.
He says it is difficult to get information out quickly because of the lack of Spanish language media in Anchorage. Churches with wide Hispanic membership are helping. He says the role of the consul in the event of an outbreak would be one of providing information, not health advice.
The recommendations would be the same ones that the World Health Organization is providing to everyone, and we would be able to provide them in Spanish, however, and let the individual know, you know, that if he has any of these symptoms or two of these symptoms, then he should consult a physician.
Cuevas says the influenza outbreak will have severe economic impact on Mexico for the time being. In Mexico City, for example, restaurants are allowed only to serve takeout meals, not because of the threat of tainted food, but because officials say gatherings of people pose a health risk. Efforts are underway to remove more oil from the storage tanks at the Drift River Terminal operated by Cook Inlet Pipeline Company. A spokeswoman with the Unified Command says by Thursday afternoon, the process should be complete. KDLL's Ben Stanton has more.
Petty Officer Sarah Francis with the Coast Guard says a tanker is at the platform to unload remaining liquid. It consists of 2.5 million gallons of oil and 140,000 gallons of water. That's what's left over after their first unloading of oil earlier this month when an erupting Mount Redoubt threatened to flood the site with lahars and water.
During the first outload, we pulled down the oil. It was all pure oil at that point. We pulled it down as far as we could. And then at that point, the weight of the fluid in the tanks was not heavy enough should a lahar or flood enter the tank farm to keep the tank grounded.
Water was forced into the two tanks to give them more weight. Now they're sucking out as much of the oil-water mix as they can before forcing more water back in, effectively diluting the mix. Francis says because oil and water stay separate when left alone, crews need to get the mixture moving using blades inside the tanks before unloading.
We're going to turn those blades on, as well as pump back and forth between the two tanks. It's like taking two glasses and shaking them together. You pour one glass into the other glass, and you pour that glass back into the other glass, and you effectively mix up what you had there to try and blend it as much as possible, and then they'll pump.
Francis says they handled the drawdown in stages because of what equipment has been on hand. Now they have a tanker available that can pump the mix. While the efforts to get the oil out are underway, the adjacent land at the facility has needed cleanup work. Although the oil tanks themselves had no reported damage, mud flows from Redoubt's strong eruptions did damage other areas like the runway. Francis says they've cleared about 3,000 feet of the landing strip.
And the reason that's important is that it takes diesel and gasoline to run the generators and the heavy equipment that's located at the facility. And some of that heavy equipment's necessary to do these clearing activities.
After the oil and water mixture is taken out, eventually the process will need to be repeated. The Unified Command hopes by that time the volcano will be considered dormant.
And they'll be able to stay on the ground for longer periods of time. And they can fully clean the tanks, which involves opening them up, bringing a vacuum truck on the premises, sucking out as much as possible, and then actually putting people inside the tank with, you know, buckets and shovels and sorbents and whatnot.
That cleaning process could take 2 to 4 months for just one of the two tanks. Francis says the oil-water mix taken out this week is unusable and will need to be disposed of, likely to be at a site in the lower 48. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
The state reached a settlement agreement yesterday with the owners of the Selendang IU. The IMC Shipping Company and IU Navigation will pay the state almost $845,000 to settle oil spill, wreck removal, and lost fish tax claims. The 738-foot freighter went aground on Unalaska Island in December of 2004 and spilled over 340,000 gallons of heavy fuel oil and 60,000 tons of soybeans. Six crew members died during the rescue efforts. Senior Assistant Attorney General Breck Tostevin says the amount of the fine is based on a legal calculation.
It's a formula that's in statute and regulation. It depends on how much oil is spilled and where it goes and what kind of receiving environment it goes into. And there's a credit for how much oil is cleaned up by the company. So the state hired a oil spill modeling firm to help us try to determine how much of the oil actually hit the beaches and how much could be credited against the penalty.
The penalty's size also varies based on the types of oil released and the affected environment types, too. The Malaysian flag Selendang IU released oil onto beaches with marine mammal haulouts and into salmon streams. The $845,000 penalty is in addition to the $100 million spent by the companies for the cleanup, a $9 million federal criminal penalty, and a $2.5 million reimbursed to the state for its cleanup costs. Still to come, state residents help design a new breed of ferry.
You never know where the good ideas are going to come from. Things that are so obvious that we just haven't thought of yet. And sometimes we just got to laugh because, wow, we missed that one.
That's ahead on Alaska News Nightly. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
The Obama administration has rolled back a change to the Endangered Species Act instituted at the end of President Bush's term in office. Federal agencies will again have to consult with federal wildlife experts before taking actions that might affect a threatened or endangered species. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service or the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration must make an independent review of proposed development or construction projects. President Bush's administration changed the Endangered Species Act 6 weeks before leaving office to make consulting federal wildlife experts optional. Interior Department Secretary Ken Salazar and Commerce Secretary Gary Locke announced the reversal today. Salazar's press secretary Kendra Barkoff says it should strengthen the Endangered Species Act.
The decision today will revoke an 11th-hour Bush administration rule that undermined the Endangered Species Act.
The Interior Department did not make any announcements or changes today on another Bush-era decision, the so-called polar bear rule. It prohibits using the Endangered Species Act to regulate activities or projects outside the Arctic that emit greenhouse gases. Barkoff says Secretary Salazar has not yet made a decision on that rule.
At this time, we're still reviewing the polar bear rule. We have until May 9th to do so, and we are still in the process of determining what we are going to do on that.
Alaska's congressional delegation, the state and pro-development interests are hopeful the Interior Department will keep the polar bear rule, but environmental groups like Greenpeace are pushing for the change. Melanie Duchin works in the organization's Anchorage office. She says the polar bear's survival depends on it.
It's very, very clear that the biggest threat to polar bears is global warming. And here we have an opportunity for Salazar to get rid of the very rule that limits the federal government's ability to even look at global warming when trying to protect the polar bears. So we're very, very hopeful, and we're hoping that he's going to do the right thing before May 9th.
Pro-development interests are afraid reversing the rule might put a halt to all sorts of construction projects throughout the country, such as coal-fired power plants. Senator Lisa Murkowski cast a vote this afternoon against President Obama's nominee for Secretary of Health and Human Services. Despite that, Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius was successfully confirmed on a vote of 65-31. Murkowski says she's concerned with what she calls Sebelius's apparent lack of interest in Indian health issues. Murkowski says during her own time on the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, she's realized the Indian Health Service needs major improvements and better funding.
We have in many, many ways failed them with IHS. And when I asked the governor for her input on it, it was really vague and non-committal. But I think the thing that concerned me most was almost like a lack of interest. And that was a problem.
The senator says it was hard to vote against Sebelius since she usually gives deference to president's choices of cabinet members. Alaska's freshman senator, Democrat Mark Begich, did vote for the president's nominee and says he's confident she'll respond to the needs of Native Americans. He says his office has not heard from the Alaska Native community that they are concerned about Sebelius.
We haven't heard any complaints, any issues or concerns. And like I said, our staff has had good conversation with her staff and feel very reassured of her position and long-term commitment to Indian Health Services and First People of this country.
Begich says he's especially glad Sebelius can take the reins now as Director of Health and Human Services in the wake of the swine flu outbreak. Sebelius's confirmation was held up earlier this month by a handful of Republicans concerned about her pro-choice voting record. Public hearings have been held throughout Southeast and in Anchorage to take suggestions and answer questions about a new generation of the Alaska Marine Highway Fleet. More meetings are scheduled for this evening in Wrangell and next month in Skagway and Haines. As KTOO's Rebecca Shear reports, the project team is impressed by what it's heard so far, but it has a long way to go before the Alaska class becomes a reality.
Okay, here's a riddle for you. What do you get when you take
the bow thruster power on the Malaspina, plus the rudder power of the Taku, and the maneuverability of the Lakani,
and whip them into a brand new ship? According to AMHS construction manager Robert Exe, you get something approaching the new
Alaska class ferry.
This is like the love child of the entire existing fleet. Like all the best DNA features.
I've never heard it put that way.
AMHS has teamed with Seattle's Elliott Bay Design Group to draw up plans for the three vessels. Each will carry up to 500 passengers and 60 vehicles. From the outside, the ships will resemble the Taku, Malaspina, and Matanuska. But Exe says they'll only be about 350 feet long.
A stretched Lakani. I couldn't resist.
Other details are a bit hazier. The team won't enter the preliminary design phase until mid-May, after public comments. And Deputy Transportation Commissioner Jim Beadle has been inspired and surprised by the feedback thus far.
You never know where the good ideas are going to come from. Things that are so obvious that we just haven't thought of yet. And sometimes we just got to laugh because, wow, we missed that one.
Like the suggestion from Ketchikan about including family restrooms, or the request from Sitka for flip-up desktops so passengers can work in their seats. Then there was the guy who asked about a solarium.
You would think that it would be the young teenager or the outdoorsman or something. This was an elderly gentleman, and he says, well, would you please consider putting tent tie-downs on the solarium aft deck so my tent... I mean, this is an elderly gentleman, so his tent doesn't blow over the side.
The Alaska-class ferries will not sail overnight, but the routes, which have yet to be decided, could last up to 10 hours. And though people have clamored for staterooms...
And we're sympathetic, and we're empathetic to that.
Construction manager Exe says it wouldn't be financially responsible.
To go on a short run, to have a cabin might be a nice thing, but it does increase the cost of that platform, of that vessel, substantially.
In lieu of staterooms, each ship will have 4 quiet rooms. Passengers can request these small locked spaces to, say, calm an infant, or if their traveling partner is looking a little green around the gills. Speaking of green, just how much will this whole endeavor cost? The project team has been tight-lipped on the matter, though AMHS General Manager Captain John Falvey gave a general estimate in February at the public meeting in Juneau.
You go and try to build a new mainline, I'm saying probably $350 a month. One of these is somewhere in the vicinity of $85 million.
Or more. Deputy Commissioner Beadle says it's too early to make a firm estimate. The team is using federal funds to design the Alaska-class ferries. They're looking into federal money for building, too, but so far they're relying solely on state coffers. As of now, they have $60 million set aside. So as Beadle and Exe explain,
we're trying to design what it says, a class of vessel, and we want to get it right. So when it's done, we'll see how good of a job we did, and if the people above us say, good job, go do it.
So there's a chance that none of this might happen. I mean, you said whether or not we get
that's
funded.
That's correct.
We have the authority to design the vessel. And that's the limit of our current authority.
Preliminary design wraps up in October. The team hopes to complete the detailed design, with all the specifications shipyards need to bid on construction, by March 2010. If the powers that be do end up praising Beadle, Exe, and Company for a good job, building could start as early as next July. But the team predicts it could be another 3 to 5 years after that, before its love child would sail its way into the world. In Juneau, I'm Rebecca Shear.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Comfort Suites Anchorage International Airport. Comfort Suites, an all suites hotel, is now open with a 24-hour shuttle service, indoor pool, and high-speed internet access. Reservations at 243-8080. And by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
A spokeswoman for Governor Sarah Palin says she is going to accept most federal stimulus funding. Spokeswoman Sharon Lehigh says Palin is only likely to reject $29 million for a state energy program because she believes it to be tied to developing a statewide energy code. Palin had initially indicated she did not want to accept about a third of the $930 million available to Alaska because of strings attached that would bind the state in the future. Legislative budget leaders couldn't find those strings, however. Lawmakers passed bills accepting nearly all funds available to Alaska. Southeast's largest tribal organization is moving in some new directions. Tlingit-Haida Central Council officials discussed innovative programs at their recent General Assembly in Juneau. Some are funded by federal stimulus money. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Tlingit-Haida Central Council's Economic Development Department is opening a business center in Haidaberg. It's based on a similar operation in Angoon that offers job training and support for entrepreneurial efforts. New directions for the Tlingit-Haida Regional Housing Authority include working toward senior apartments in several communities. Tribal Services Director Ricardo Worrell says the Yakutat tribe has already secured a federal grant to perform needed studies.
We want to build up to 10 or 12 units for senior housing attached to this senior facility. So that's sort of on a fast track. If we have time, we are looking at senior centers in Juneau and Saxman, and possible job training associated with all of our projects.
Federal economic stimulus funding would pay for the work. Worrell says those funds will also help create a summer employment program aimed at sprucing up neighborhoods.
We will be hiring up to 60 employees region-wide. Each community, each tribal council will be in charge of hiring up to five summer employees for neighborhood revitalization, which will include yard work, landscaping, you know, beautification of community facilities. And the idea being is that we just want to get employment opportunities. We want to get some of the money spent right away in the communities.
The Central Council's Energy Department is also looking at new directions. It's proposed forming a regional transmission organization, or RTO, with representatives from a number of Southeast communities. Tribal Energy Director Percy Frisbee says the organization is the best way to oversee management of the region's developing power grid.
We have a number of hydro projects that are just sitting right now because we have no grid system. It's almost impossible to develop them because they have no way to bust their power. So if we get a grid system built, the RTO lends itself a lot more to adding new systems.
He says a regional authority would encourage power sharing, and it could attract funding that the current patchwork of private and public systems might not.
We can't force it on anybody. And what we're doing is just saying, okay, this is an alternative and an option to what we're dealing with right now, and if we get communities interested enough and can see the benefit of an RTO, then they can join it.
Another Central Council program, the Tribal Child Support Unit, is expanding its operations. Employment and Training Director Alberta Aspen told delegates at the Assembly that the unit had about 65 cases in 2007. It's now up to about 600.
We want to make sure that our children receive financial and emotional support from both parents, to provide quality customer service to custodial parents and non-custodial parents. We provide family assessment, child support needs, referrals to appropriate agencies for support services. We locate parents and assets, and tracing and collection of payments.
She says the council's employment program is also looking at adding new programs to help jobless tribal members develop skills. That's in addition to vocational training that's already offered.
We are looking at ways that we can help people by giving them a strong network, giving them something that they can hold on to, giving them some sense of pride, and giving them some information. We're going to have a fatherhood program. We want to start a young mothers program. We want to increase the youth and cultural activities. We are already holding financial literacy classes, but we want to increase those. And then we want to start other kinds of women's and men's groups that are support groups.
The council also provides Head Start, tribal courts, scholarship, repatriation, and subsistence support programs. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
State and federal biologists are predicting a poor Chinook or king salmon return this summer on the Yukon River and are preparing to restrict fishing. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
They're planning to ban all commercial fishing for kings and halt subsistence fishing during the first pulse of the king salmon run. After that, they are planning to cut subsistence fishing by 50%. John Linderman is the state's regional supervisor for the Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim region. He says they are focusing on getting half the king run beyond the Canadian border this summer, a goal that was not met last year.
We need to ensure that we achieve that long-term average of approximately half of the run needs to get into Canada.
Last year, Canada only saw about 30% of the king run. But according to a treaty between the two countries, the U.S. is obligated to provide proper escapements so that Canada can get half the run. Biologists have been studying Yukon king salmon for years through test fishery projects, sonars, weirs, counting towers, and genetic sampling. This won't be the first low-run year for the fish. Linderman says it's progressively getting worse since 2007. So why are kings not returning to the Yukon?
Well, it's the million-dollar question, I guess you could call it. To some extent, we don't know.
Like other salmon species on the Yukon, kings usually enter the river in pulses, which can last around 4 days long. Biologists hope by banning subsistence fishing for kings during the first pulse, tens of thousands of fish will make it to Canada. After the first pulse, subsistence fishers will be restricted to a fishing schedule for king salmon. Biologists are planning to allow half of the standard fishing schedule that fishers had last year. It's all subject to change and will all depend on what the run assessment is when the first pulse of kings hit the river. But for right now, what biologists see is pretty bleak.
Currently, the plan going into the season is anticipation of a very low return. And after that first closure on that first pulse, when the first windowed periods do open throughout the entire drainage from the lower river going all the way up to the border, then we'd be looking at having half the time available for those subsistence openings.
As for the Yukon's other salmon runs, summer chum, fall chum, and coho salmon are all expected to be of average strength this year. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Ben Stanton in Kenai and Hillman in Unalaska, Rebecca Shear and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fike. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.